Hi, everybody. Now I'm not muted. Right? You're hearing me? Yes, good. Okay. Hi, everybody. So today we are going to go up on the heights of Mount Scopus. We've had a lot of nice rain here in the last couple of days, so this would not be a good day to go really to Mount Scopus, but it will work very nicely for Zoom.
You got that on the line. You
Okay,
wanted to
so
go.
we are gonna visit
Oh,
Mount
you did
Scopus,
it.
which is a very interesting place. We don't always
Well,
think
that
about it as
ruins
a
a piece
place
of
to go
paper I
visit.
drew.
If anybody goes
Yeah.
up there, it's usually either because you're going to the hospital,
That's too
hopefully
bad.
not, right? Or you're going, or students who are going to the university. But it's really got so many pieces and so much history to it, and it's a fascinating place in and of itself. Mount Scopus has always been, right? Same thing like with the Mount of Olives that we did in the last series. It's always historically been outside the city, right? To the northeast of the city. It's been a place that the city has been attacked from. Okay. It also was a place that was good for burial because it's outside the city. Today, it's within the city boundaries of Jerusalem, but it has an interesting status as we're going to see. I gave it the title Mount Scopus, the New Jerusalem, because in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, right, before the War of Independence, there was a feeling that the future of Jerusalem is going to be on Mount Scopus, that this is going to be the place of kind of the new rebuilt temple. I'm using that word advisedly, right? We're going to see that's the word that a lot of people who were involved with the university used. They didn't mean a temple like the Beit HaMikdash. They meant the modern equivalent of a temple. But there was this grand vision of what Mount Scopus was going to be, which didn't actually come to fruition. Why? Because as we're going to see, 1948, Mount Scopus remains in Israeli hands, but on the Jordanian side of the city. Okay, so we could call it in Hebrew, hachalom v'shivro, right? It's the dream and the reality, what actually happened in the dream. So let's actually get started. So we're going to look in a map in a minute and see exactly what we're talking about. And when we look at the map, we will see that basically, Mount Scopus is the Mount of Olives, right? Har HaTzofim in Hebrew, Har HaZeitim, they're all part of the same mountain range. In Israel, very few mountains are standalone little gumdrop mountains. Most of them are mountain ranges. Mount of Olives is no exception. It has different pieces, okay? And Mount Scopus is just one of the parts of the Mount of Olives, the northernmost part of this eastern ridge of the city. So why does it have that name? Now, it's a name that we have already in our sources, right? Not in Tanakh, but we have it in a Gemara, right? Very well-known Gemara. I'm sure a lot of people will be familiar with this Gemara. I only brought you the very beginning, right? This is one of the stories that we have of Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues, and how Rabbi Akiva is different from his colleagues, that he is the ultimate optimist. Right. So here we have Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues. They were ascending to Jerusalem after the destruction of the temple. When they arrived at Mount Scopus, right, Higiu LaTzofim, it says in Hebrew, and they saw the site of the temple. They rent their garments in mourning, in keeping with halachic practice. Hey, they arrived at the Temple Mount. They saw a fox. They began weeping. Rabbi Akiva was laughing, right? If you're familiar with the story, of course, they say, well, why are you weeping? And why are you laughing? And he says, why are you weeping? They say, we're weeping because this incredibly holy place here, there's a fox coming out. Out of it, an animal coming out of it, what a desecration. And Rabbi Akiva is laughing because he says if the terrible prophecy of the destruction has come true, then it's inevitable that the prophecy of the consolation of the rebuilding is going to come true. What's important for us is this word Tzofim, right? They came to Tzofim, Scopus, a place where you could see the temple. Now, is that Har HaZeitim? Chances are good, right? It's definitely a place from which you can see the Temple Mount, but it doesn't tell us specifically. Tzofim just means a lookout point, right? A tatzpit, a place that you can see something from. When did the name Scopus become equated with the site that we're going to talk about today? Actually, very interestingly, only in the beginning of the 20th century. As we're going to see, there's an idea that develops among the Zionist movement to create a Jewish university. They acquire a piece of land at this northern edge of the Mount of Olives, And then what do you need to do? You need to fundraise, right? So they start fundraising and they go to the diaspora and they say, we want to build a university. And people say, well, where's your university going to be? You can't say on the Mount of Olives. What do Jews in the diaspora think when they hear the Mount of Olives? They think cemetery. Why would you build something on a cemetery? So this is what we today would call rebranding or marketing, right? They take this piece of the mountain and they give it a new name rather than having to explain, no, it's not the part of the sun, right? So it's really the same mountain. And that's what we can see nicely over here, just to give us a little bit of a sense of where we are, right? So here's the old city, right? Here's the old city, Damascus Gate. Here's the Temple Mount over here, the Western Wall, right? Old city going around over here. Where is Har HaTzofim, right? Har HaZeitim is this ridge to the east. All along the east, the cemetery is down in the southern part, and the area of Mount Scopus is up here in the northern part. Okay, I hope that makes sense for everybody. The other thing, sorry, my drawing skills are not so great. The other thing that's important to see, right, the mountain is, like we call Har HaZeitim, the Mount of Olives, it's the mountain to the east of the city, Ha'har Asher Mikedem La'ir. But what is to the east of Mount Scopus? Okay, to the east of Mount Scopus is the desert. Okay, and that's very clear when you go up on Mount Scopus, when you go to the university, you have parts in the university where you have an amazing lookout to the Temple Mount, and you have parts of the university where you have an amazing lookout to the desert. And Mount Scopus, the Mount of Olives, is really on that border between the two, right? When we did the class on the Mount of Olives, we talked about sending out the Seir La'Azazel, right? The goat on Yom Kippur is sent out over the Mount of Olives and out into the desert. So the desert is very, very close by. We're going to see a nice lookout a little bit later, but that's just to understand where we are. We're on the eastern border of the city with the desert further to the east of us and all the rest of Jerusalem to the west of us. Okay, so that's just our locations. Moving along, okay, what are we going to be seeing up on our tour on Mount Scopus? Okay, so most of what we are seeing, right, Mount Scopus, obviously the mountain exists, you know, since the topography of Jerusalem exists, but most of what's built on the mountain is new, as in from the 20th century. Okay, we hear about this area of Jerusalem. We heard about it with Rabbi Akiva. We hear about it when Titus comes, the Roman general comes to conquer the city. He camps on the northeastern part of the city. That's his place, his staging grounds from where he attacks. But in general, we don't have much that's built up here. Okay. We're going to be talking about a number of places. We're going to talk about the British Military Cemetery, which is put here once the British come in, the beginning of the British Mandate after World War One. We're going to be talking about Hadassah, and we're going to be talking about Hebrew University. Don't pay attention, temporarily closed. I think I took this map during COVID, and that's why it's temporarily closed, right? So here's a Hebrew University. All of these things are built in the 20th century. The only built structure that we have from earlier is an estate that was built by a British Christian Zionist. We're going to come to that. And on his estate, he discovered something very old, but I'm not going to wreck our surprises. So this is where we're going to be. We're going to start in the cemetery. We're going to move to the Hadassah Hospital and then spend much of our time in the university. Okay, so here we are in the cemetery. The British, right, we know the British conquer the land of Israel from the Ottoman Turks in World War One. Okay, they come up from Egypt at the end of October 1917. They conquer Gaza and they conquer Beersheba, and then they continue going towards the north. By December 1917, they have taken Jerusalem, and then by 1918, they take the rest of the country and they take the north. And unfortunately, they have many casualties from this war, from World War I. And this is one of five, we'll see some of the others. This is one of five British military cemeteries that we have in the land of Israel. This one has, in particular, it has a memorial for the unknown soldiers in the memorial chapel. We'll see that in a minute. But there are over 2,500 graves in the cemetery. And then there are on the walls of the chapel, 3,366 unknown soldiers. Okay? And as you can see, if you can see it on the inscription here, Jerusalem War Cemetery, the land on which the cemetery stands is the free gift of the people of Palestine for the perpetual resting place of those of the Allied armies who fell in the war of 1914 to 1918 and are honored here. Okay, so you have British soldiers who fall in their service in the country in mandatory Palestine, but that's not what this is. This is for World War I. We are going to see a couple of the others. Somebody said about Australians in Beersheba. Correct. Australians are part of the British war effort, right? The Anzac, Australian and New Zealand soldiers, along with Canadian soldiers and British soldiers, where this is still the time of the British Empire, right? We're even going to see Indian soldiers. Okay, the cemeteries in Israel are uniform. They are actually cared for by the British government, and they're incredibly beautiful. We'll see a picture in a minute of the graves, and it's all meticulously cared for, right? They are very, very careful. They are all in cross shape, although we're going to see there are some Jewish cemeteries. Okay, there is a chapel here. And as we said, on the walls here are the names of the unknown soldiers. In the cemetery here, you have 24 identified Jewish soldiers. They're in one particular section of the cemetery, and you can see they have a Magen David, right, a Star of David on them. This army, as well as many other circumstances, we have Jews who it was not known that they were Jewish, and they were buried with a cross on their grave. And there's actually an organization today that's working to discover the roots of soldiers, particularly soldiers in the Allied armies in World War II in Europe who are buried in Europe and identifying their graves. Every year, there, and you can see here, right, the names of the officers of the armies of the United Kingdom, India, and South Africa. Okay, so it's not the Anzac soldiers, the Australians and the New Zealanders. That's in Beersheba. We're going to see in a minute, but this is the others. Every year there is a ceremony here, right, in the second week in November, and it's a ceremony like they have in other parts of the United Kingdom, poppies, bagpipes. One of the things that's, I think, very powerful here, and Israel took this legacy for their own military cemeteries, is that all of the headstones are identical. Right, regardless of rank, whether you could be a soldier who served for a week, you could be a general who served for 30 years, you get the same headstone. And Israel does that for our soldiers as well. So that's just important to understand. And as you walk around the cemetery, you can see where they're from, you can see the units that they served in. And yes, as Ruth wrote, many people, many young, very young soldiers. On the other hand, we have to understand, I think it's important, first of all, here you have a vision of a photograph of more of the cemetery, and it's really a very dignified and very beautiful place. One of the things that's very important to understand here, as much as World War I was in many ways very senseless and terrible carnage in Europe, in the land of Israel, it was really very important because the Ottoman Turks were in charge here. The Ottoman Turks, by the 20th century, were very cruel rulers. We know about the story of the Armenian genocide. They didn't do anything as horrible in the land of Israel, but they were not good to the Jews here. The minimum was that they neglected everything and they didn't take care of things and the garbage wasn't picked up and the sanitation was horrible. And on the worst end of the spectrum, they hung people, they expelled people. So when the British came in, as much as we have a very complicated relationship with the British Mandate, it was seen by everyone as, okay, this is much better. This is a step up. This is a step towards creating a Jewish state. So it really did have a strong impact in the land of Israel. The other thing I wanted to show you here, some of you may recognize the title here, "To We Have Built Jerusalem." This is a famous British hymn that's a poem written by William Blake. And the tagline of it is, "Till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land." Okay? Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem, right, is going to be in England. And there always has been a strain, of British people who are philo-Semitic, and I don't know if this is a proper, this is an actual term, but philo-Israel, right, who feel very connected to Jerusalem, to the land of Israel, to the extent even that they see England as England's green and pleasant land as the new Jerusalem. Now, when the cemetery is built, one of the conditions that the British make is that they should always have an unobstructed view of the old city, right? That there should never be something built in between. And in this picture, you really don't see it very well. It's because these trees need to be trimmed. But in fact, there has not been any building that has gone up since 1918 between the cemetery and the old city, and they have an unobstructed view except for the trees, which need to be trimmed. The British couldn't really guarantee that. The municipality of Jerusalem after the Six-Day War actually takes on that responsibility. And I think it's a very powerful thing, this deep connection that the British have with Jerusalem. As we said, as we mentioned, five British military cemeteries in the land of Israel. You have this one, of course. You have the ANZAC, the Australian and New Zealand Armored Corps in Beersheba, and they are the ones who really took Beersheba, and it is a very significant story. In Ramla, in Haifa, and in Gaza. The picture you see here on the left is of the Australian and New Zealand cemetery in Beersheba, in honor of the 100th anniversary of the taking of Beersheba, right, in 2017. The Australian government, like with the government of Israel, they worked incredibly fast, and they built this really great new museum about the taking of Beersheba and the military campaign here. It's really very, very interesting. There's one more cemetery, which doesn't really count as an official, it is official, but it's much smaller and it's not a cemetery per se, it's a memorial. And that's what you see here in the picture on the right here. And this is the memorial in Talpiot. It's a very interesting thing. If you live in Jerusalem and you wander around the streets of Arnona, you will come upon this very perfectly manicured lawn behind a fence. And inside, there are monuments to the Indian soldiers in the British Army, right, who are not buried with everyone because they're Hindu and they're Muslim, right? And there also are for Turkish soldiers, right, from the Ottoman Turks. And this is a memorial and a common grave for some of these soldiers, and they're in a separate place. So that's just an interesting, strange little thing that you will see. As you wander around in Talpiot, right? Irene says the music is amazing. It is amazing. It's a beautiful hymn. Anybody wants to listen to it later? William Blake, "Till We Have Built Jerusalem." I don't think that's the official title, but I'm sure somebody knows better than I do, and we'll put it in the chat. Okay, we're moving on to Hadassah. Okay, so Hadassah Hospital is, of course, a very significant institution in Jerusalem and in Israel in general. It's a very important modern hospital. Today we have two Hadassahs. We'll talk about that as we go on. But the original building is on Mount Scopus. Hadassah, we'll get to Henrietta Szold in a minute, but Hadassah's presence begins in the land of Israel in 1912 with health clinics, right? Tipat Chalav, mother and baby clinics. Okay? In 1921, there's the Rothschild Hospital. Okay? There's hospitals in Tel Aviv and in Haifa. And then there's a need to build a bigger hospital in Jerusalem in place of the Rothschild one. And this is going to be the hospital that is built in Jerusalem on Mount Scopus. Okay? Mount Scopus, why Mount Scopus? There's extra space there, and again, it's part of this vision of what Mount Scopus is going to become. So you can see the building. We'll talk about the architect in a minute. It's a very interesting mix, the facade of East and West, right? Of kind of very modern, almost like a brutalist sort of an architecture, but with these domes that soften it, and that's the more Eastern influence. Hadassah, has health clinics, one of the very first clinics. It's not something that Hadassah advertises so much today, but it's certainly something important and interesting to know. Some people may recognize this building. This is Beit Hadassah in Hebron. Okay. In Hebron, before 1929, when Hebron was a very thriving Jewish community, Hadassah builds this beautiful building. It doesn't build the building, excuse me. It's a building that's standing already. They take over this beautiful building and they make it into one of the very first health clinics in the land of Israel. Later on, of course, many years later, in the 1970s, the women and the children from Kiryat Arba, right next to Hebron, move into the abandoned Hadassah building in the abandoned Beit Hadassah, and squat there from 1979 to 1980 until they are given permission to have a Jewish community in Hebron proper. But that's a different story. But this is Beit Hadassah in Hebron. Where's Hadassah coming from, right? Hadassah, of course, is founded by this very formidable little woman in her cute little hat, but she was a much tougher cookie than she looks. And this, of course, is Henrietta Zold. Now, Henrietta Zold is really one of the great Jewish women. I always like to start talking about her by mentioning the year she was born and the year she died, because it just, you can see encompassed, she led a long life. And she encompassed so many major events in world history in her life. She was born in 1860 in Baltimore, the United States, 1860, beginning of the Civil War. She died in 1945 in Jerusalem, at the end of World War II. She's buried on Har HaZeitim in Jerusalem. Think about all the changes in the world in that time. Henrietta Zold is born to a couple in Baltimore, Rabbi Binyamin Zold and his wife. They were very, very involved both in helping Jewish immigration. There were a lot of Jews who came through Baltimore in the late 19th century, and they would take them in, they would help them, they would teach them. Henrietta Zold was very involved in this, in teaching the new immigrants. She was one of eight daughters. Okay. And as often happens in a family where you have a very learned father and only daughters, right? The daughters start to learn. The daughters are being taught by the father. And Henrietta Zold became a real Jewish scholar. She applies to the Jewish Theological Seminary, right? This is long before women were accepted as rabbis in the conservative movement. She applies to the seminary. She's accepted on condition that she does not work towards smicha. She cannot be ordained, but she can study in the Jewish Theological Seminary, and she does. She becomes a very important person in the Jewish Publication Society. She really is a going force, but then her life takes a very different course. She has an unrequited love affair. Her heart is broken. She's not so young anymore. She's in her 40s. And what does a mother do when her daughter's heart is broken? Henrietta's mother says, let's take a trip. They take a trip to the land of Israel. And this is 1909. And she is both delighted and horrified, right? She comes to the land of Israel. She's amazed. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. Everything is great. But she sees the state of healthcare, which is abysmal, right? And she's very distressed. Now, she's not somebody who's just going to be, you know, go home and cry and that'll be the end of it. She goes home and she gathers the women in her community. And the first meeting is held right before Purim. And so they decide to name the organization that they create Hadassah, right? Hadassah is another name for Queen Esther. And they create this movement that is meant to provide health care in the land of Israel. And she goes back and forth, and she travels back and forth, and she's involved in creating the health clinics and the hospital, and eventually she's involved in Youth Aliyah, and she very much takes an active part in the creation of this hospital. The very aristocratic-looking gentleman on the right here is the architect of the hospital. His name is Eric Mendelssohn. He had an architecture firm in Berlin, and he became very well known and well off by working in tandem with another important Jew in Berlin, and that's Zalman Schocken. Zalman Schocken, some people might be familiar with Schocken Press. Zalman Chacon did not make his money from printing books. Books are not a way to make money. Books are a way to lose money. He made his money from a chain of department stores, and the buildings were designed by Eric Mendelsohn. Together, they worked well together. Of course, what happened then is it became a very uncomfortable place for a Jew to be in Berlin in the 1930s. Chacon moves first. He manages to get some of his fortune out, but mostly not. And then he commissions Mendelssohn to come and to build him a house in Jerusalem. And that, along with other commissions to build Chaim Weizmann's house in Rehovot and other things, brings Mendelssohn to the land of Israel first. He commutes back and forth, and then he and his wife see that there's no future in Germany. And he comes here, and he becomes involved in the building of Hadassah. Eric Mendelssohn was perhaps a great architect, but he was not exactly a modest man. Someone once asked him in Berlin why he didn't have any partners in his architecture firm. And he said, when God made the world, did he have partners? So that's the kind of guy this guy was. And he didn't get along so well with people in Hadassah. He did design this first building, but eventually it doesn't go. It's not a match. He doesn't stick around. Hadassah is built, and it becomes a very significant hospital. And then tragedy strikes. And we talked about this in the last class. So I won't talk too much about it here. But in April, on April 13th, 1948, right in the midst of the War of Independence, a convoy of doctors and nurses and supplies and equipment is going up to Mount Scopus. It's ambushed by Arabs in Sheikh Jarrah, it's attacked and fired upon for hours and hours and hours. The British do not step in. The British don't come until 8 hours after the attacks begin. This is called Shayeret Ha'Ein Chet, the caravan of the 78, because there are 78. Today we know it's 77, but for many years we thought it was 78 people who are murdered in this attack. The outcome, besides the terrible number of fatalities, is that the hospital on Har HaTzofim is not used anymore. Right? It becomes clear, if it hadn't been clear before, that they cannot endanger the patients and the doctors and the nurses anymore. And so the hospital stops being used, even when Mount Scopus stays in Israeli hands, and they have to find alternative places for the hospital. We'll come back to that in 1 second. Between 48 and 67, the hospital is not used as a hospital. There are Israeli soldiers on Mount Scopus. They use the buildings for their own purposes, but the hospital is not used, and a new hospital is built. Today, the hospital has two different locations on Givat Ra'an in Ein Karem, right at the edge of the city, and they've come returned back to Mount Scopus. It kept the original facade and the original building, but they modernized it completely inside. Today, there are more than 1 million patients a year that pass through Hadassah Hospital. There are more than 13,000 births every year in Hadassah Hospital. So it's really it had a financial crisis a few years ago. It seems to be doing better now. If you're wondering what is the thing on the right here, I learned long ago not to criticize art because I really don't know very much. But I personally don't like it. It's a sculpture on the grounds of Hadassah by a sculptor called Jacques Lipschitz, and it's supposed to have all sorts of Jewish representation, like the Ten Commandments at the top, right? And that's one of the things that's on the Mount Scopus campus. We are going to move over to the university. Okay, we'll get to the idea of the university in a moment. But before there was a university on Mount Scopus, there was an estate. Okay, and the estate was owned by this gentleman. His name was Sir John Grey Hill. Okay, he and his wife were Christian Zionists, and they would come to the land of Israel rather frequently. This is in the late 19th century. And he actually he was a very interesting guy. He really believed that there should be a state of the Jews. He believed that there should be a Jewish university with the language of instruction being Hebrew. This is before Zionism thought about this. He thought about this. And in the late 1880s, he and his wife buy a piece of land on Mount Scopus, nothing on Mount Scopus at the time, and they figure it's a good place to build their estate, and they do. After World War I, he A, believes in this idea of the university, and B, is kind of in need of cash, and he sells the land that his estate is on to Arthur Rubin, right? Arthur Rubin, one of the major Zionist operatives. And that is where the university is built. I think it's very sad. You walk around on the campus, the renewed campus of Mount Scopus, there's one tiny little sign to Sir John Grey Hill. His house is no longer standing. Nobody talks about it. Nobody thinks about him. But he's really the reason that the university is in this particular location, because this was where they could buy land. In 1902, as part of his daughter was actually involved in adding to the estate, and she discovers something very interesting. Okay? She discovers burial caves. Okay? Now, these burial caves had ossuaries in them. We're going to see ossuary in a minute. Ossuary is a bone box, right? The way people buried in Second Temple times and somewhat afterwards is they would let the body decompose, and then you'd take the bones and you'd put them in a box, right? This is only for the wealthy, and then it's put into a cave. Okay. So she discovers the cave with niches that are in it and with some ossuaries inside. Okay, that's already very exciting. So we're talking about a burial cave that goes back to Second Temple times. Makes sense because here we are outside the city, right? You don't bury in the city, but outside the city, you can bury anywhere, and people are always looking for good places to bury. Mount Scopus was not so far away from Jerusalem, so it was a very good location for burial. So here you can see the niches, right, where the in the burial cave where the ossuaries were, and some of the ossuaries. Okay, and as you can see, they're decorated very beautifully. Nothing representational, just kind of geometric figures. We found many ossuaries in Jerusalem. Okay? We found many burial niches in Jerusalem. This is not an uncommon thing to find. But what they found on one of the ossuaries is extraordinary, and that's what you see here on the bottom. If you want to see the real one, you have to go to the British Museum. This is an inscription, and you can see there are actually inscriptions in two different languages. Okay. And I will underline. You have a Greek inscription over here. Okay. And then on the bottom, you have a very short Hebrew inscription, just two words. Okay. The Hebrew inscription says Nicanor Alexa. Okay. The Greek inscription says Nicanor of Alexandria, who made the gates. Okay, now this is nice in and of itself, meaning here we have a guy who clearly is Jewish. He has a Hebrew inscription, but he clearly also knows Greek. We know where he's from. He has a Greek name, right? Very nice, except it's actually even nicer because we know who Nicanor of Alexandria is. We hear about him in our sources, and we hear about him making the gates exactly like the inscription tells us. Okay, we have a few sources. A few places that this story is told in the Gemara, okay, about a very wealthy man named Nicanor, and how he wanted, this is during Second Temple times, he wanted to give a gift to the temple. And so he had beautiful copper gates designed, right? And then he had to bring them to Jerusalem. So he's in Alexandria in Egypt, right? He's on the Mediterranean. So he hires a boat. They set off, they set sail to bring the gates to the land of Israel, right? One version of the Gemara says they're going to Yafo. One version says they're going to Akko. Okay? Along the way, there's a terrible storm. The ship is in danger. The sailors are not happy. And they say, okay, we're throwing one of the gates overboard. And they throw one of the gates overboard. Nicanor, of course, is distraught, but there's nothing much you can do. The storm continues. And the sailors say, okay, we got to throw the other one. And Nicanor throws himself on the gate. And he says, if you throw the other one in the sea, I'm going with it. And at that point, the storm abates. Everything calms down. They make it to the shore, Yafo, Akko, one of them. And what do they find on the beach? The gate that they had thrown overboard, right? And the rabbis say, because Nicanor was clearly such a worthy person, he deserves to have his gates placed in a very important place in the temple. And in fact, gates, the Nicanor gates, are placed between the women's court, the Ezrat Nashim, and the Azara, the place where the sacrifices are given. So it's a very strategic point, very important point in the temple. So we have the story in the Gemara, and to be able to find Nicanor's grave, that's amazing, right? So that's what we have. We'll look back one more time just because it's so cool, right? So here's Nicanor, who made the gates. Now, in the 20th century, one of the very important Zionist leaders was someone named Menachem Uzishkin, and he heard this story about the burial caves and Nicanor, and he believes that the future of Jerusalem is going to be Mount Scopus. The university is going to be here. The hospital is here. This is where we want to have everything, right? This is going to be the modern pantheon of the state of Israel. And in 1934, Uzishkin arranges to have Leo Pinsker, who is the founder of the Lovers of Zion organization, one of the earliest Zionist organizations, the Hove Tzion. He has him brought, he has his body brought here from Russia, from Odessa, and has him buried in one of the caves here. And he says, this is going to be the place where all of the most important Zionist leaders are going to be buried. So I'm burying Pinsker here. And guess who's going to be buried with him? Another extraordinarily important Zionist leader? Me. Right? That's basically what he says. And in the end, Zishkin is indeed buried here, right? So Uzishkin is buried here. You can see here his dates. He's buried here in 1942. He brings Pinsker's bones 8 years earlier. Uzishkin's a very interesting character. He's the head of JNF, of Karen Kayemet. He is what is known in Hebrew as a bulldozer. He's somebody who gets things done. He pushes things ahead. And in fact, he has two streets in Rehavia that are named after him in his lifetime. Okay, Rehov Uzishkin and Rehov Keren Kayemet, right? Keren Kayemet being his office, right, where he works. When he dies, he tells his children, I want to be buried on Mount Scopus, right, next to Pinsker. And I want you to bring bags of earth from all of the communities that I helped found, right? Keren Kayemet, the JNF. Today we think of the JNF, we think of trees, but in the beginning, JNF was about buying land and settling people in communities. He says, I want you to bring bags of earth from all of the communities that I have founded and lay them on my grave. And that's the picture that you have here on the right. So it's an amazing picture. Now, what happened to his vision? How come this is not the modern pantheon and there are only two graves here? It's the same thing that happened to Mount Scopus. Mount Scopus in 1948 becomes a dead letter. All of these wonderful, interesting modern ideas, the hospital, the university, the pantheon of Zionist leaders, it doesn't happen. We're behind enemy lines. We're in Israeli territory, but behind enemy lines in an enclave within Jordanian territory. So this doesn't come to fruition. On the campus of the university, we'll come back to the university in a minute, but on the campus of the university is a beautiful little, just a beautiful pastoral place, and it's the Botanical Gardens. Okay? The Botanical Gardens was founded, right? It was founded in the 1930s as part of the university, but it was neglected for years and years. These years between 48 and 67, it was completely neglected and overgrown, and it was only in the 2000s that it was rehabilitated by a sculptor named Ron Moore, who's done a lot of interesting things around Jerusalem. And today it's just this beautiful place to just go and to wander and to learn about the trees and the plants of the land of Israel. And it's on the campus of the university on Mount Scopus, but anybody who wants to can come in. Now, what's the idea behind it? Okay, the idea behind this botanical gardens is the same idea behind the University Department of Botany in Hebrew University, and that's to learn the botany of the land of Israel. Okay, the idea of Zionism being not just to provide a haven for the Jews, and it's not just about politics, and it's not just about settlement, but it's also about returning to our roots, in this case, really literally, and understanding the flora and the fauna of the land of Israel. And in doing so, then we will be able to understand Tanakh, and we'll be able to understand the Mishnah and the Gemara. And there's a lot of work that's done to discover the botany of the land of Israel. And this botanical gardens is part of that idea. So on the right, you have a botanist named Alexander Eig, who is planting the very first tree in the botanical gardens. You can see it was clearly a very ceremonious occasion. On the left, you have also something very interesting. You have a couple whose names are Ephraim and Chana Haruveni. They are basically the founders of the botany department in Hebrew University. And what they do is they create a library of plants, right? They collect as many Eretz Yisrael plants as they can. They try to identify them as much as they can. There's an encyclopedia. They hire an artist to draw and to paint these plants, and then to have commentary about it. It's a book that actually was just re-released. It's a beautiful book. And this is all part of the same idea. Now, if the name Ephraim and Chana Haruveni sounds vaguely familiar, somebody needs to be muted, please. It's because their son, Noga Haruveni, takes their vision and carries it much further. And he founds not just a botanical gardens, but a nature reserve that is all about the flora and fauna of the Bible and the Mishnah. And that's called Ne'oh Kedumim. And he founds that in the 60s. So he takes this idea of his parents and he carries it to the greatest degree, and he creates Ne'oh Kedumim. But it all begins with this botanical gardens in Hebrew University. And by the way, the very first biblical zoo, right? People who live in Jerusalem, who have visited Jerusalem, have perhaps gone to the beautiful zoo in the southern part of Jerusalem by Malcha. But the biblical zoo had a few incarnations, right? It used to be in Romema before the current one was built. And before that, it was actually on Mount Scopus. The zoo was here by the botanical gardens for a very short time. Okay, let's get to our story of the university. Okay, during the Zionist congresses, there are visionaries who believe that there should be a university, right? Herzl, Weizmann, who you're seeing here, Albert Einstein, we'll come back to in a minute, Chaim Weizmann, Herman Shapira, okay, who's a math professor who believes there should be a Jewish university, and the Chovevei Tzion is behind it. There are many people who think this is a good idea. It's proposed already at the Zionist Congress in 1897. But fascinatingly, there are people who object to this idea, right? Jews, Zionists who object to this idea. And they say, what? Really? We don't need more people sitting at the studying and pale. We need the new Jews who are going to go out and who are going to farm and laborers. We don't need these more yeshiva bachers sitting in the library. Fortunately, nobody listened to them. And they forged ahead with plans to create the university. Now, the vision of the university, and this is a fascinating thing. There's this very grandiose vision that this is going to become the new temple. Now, everybody uses this term. Even people who are anti-religious use this term. Hey, Weizmann and Bialik and Achad Ha'am, they all talk about it as the new temple and rebuilding the temple and the Mikdash, but they take the content of a temple, right? And they get rid of it. There's no sacrifices. There's no prayer. Instead, it's going to be all about learning. Why do they not say Beit Midrash? Why do they say Beit Mikdash? Probably because Beit Midrash has a very goistic, right? Exile connotation. We're going to sit in the study hall. No, we're going to create this temple that's going to rejuvenate Judaism. And even in the design of how it's supposed to look, as you can see from these drawings, right? This was the original vision of what the main building of the university was supposed to look like. Does it look a little familiar? It looks exactly like the Dome of the Rock. That was the context, right? And you can see it. The building was not built this way, but this was how it was designed. This is a pin that was for the opening, for the laying of the cornerstone of the university. And it's all taking on this idea of the Dome of the Rock, the Temple Mount. It visually connects with the Temple Mount. When you're on Mount Scopus, you can see to the Temple Mount, and it becomes a super important place for Zionists. The idea is this is going to take the place of the temple. This is going to become our new temple. Some of the people who are behind it, the gentleman with the fabulous beard, is a British urban planner whose name was Patrick Geddes. He is very involved in creating the urban plan for Tel Aviv. He creates this very grandiose, very expensive plan for the university, which includes this building. It's not at all practical, and it doesn't really get done. Eric Mendelsohn, who we talked about before, is involved, but then he leaves. And finally, there's an urban planner and architect named Kaufman who steps in. But then the war happens, and nothing really is completed, right? The 1948 war. So there are buildings that are built. There are some of the older buildings that you can see, but the whole plan of the campus is really kind of curtailed, is cut short. This is Yehuda Magnus, Judah Leib Magnus. He was the first chancellor of the university. He was an American from San Francisco. Reform rabbi, a pacifist. Some people suggest that he leaves his career in the United States and he comes to Israel because he became somewhat of a persona non grata when he's a pacifist during World War I, right? People don't like that so much. Why are you not supporting our boys who are fighting overseas? He comes and he heads the university at first. He's a very good fundraiser. He's very liberal. He is for a binational state of Jews and Arabs, which was really not talked about at that time, but he talks about it. The cornerstone of the university is laid in 1918, actually a nice auspicious Jewish date, Tu B'Av, right? The few days after Tisha B'Av, the day where we celebrate, where we come out of mourning. That's when the cornerstone is laid. A few buildings are built, but the official dedication is not till 1925. And you can see we have this very nice ticket of admission, right? This is the hottest ticket in town. Everybody wants to be invited to the dedication of the university. Now, you have a photograph here, which we're going to see in a minute. It was transformed into a painting that takes up a whole wall on the Hebrew University campus. It's a great painting. I'll show it to you in a second. But when everybody who's anybody comes to this event. It's really the social event of the season. So who comes? Lord Balfour and Chaim Weizmann and Chaim Nachman Bialik and Echad Ha'am and Rav Kook and Herbert Samuel, the High Commissioner of Palestine. Everybody comes to this event. Right? It is a very, very, very big deal. Right? And this is the painting that was made from this photograph, right? You can see the photograph. This is an artist named Pilchowski, and he actually put himself into the painting, which I think is the best detail here, right? Here he is painting his painting. And on the podium, you have Lord Balfour, and you could see Rav Kook, and you could see Chaim Weizmann, and all of these important dignitaries. When you go to Hebrew University, they actually have a little numbered chart that tells you who's who in all of the, in everything. It's very nice. Where are they sitting? Right. There's not that much university yet. Right. There's only a couple of buildings. They're sitting in the place that we're going to see at the very end becomes this beautiful amphitheater that looks out on the desert. But the amphitheater has not really been created yet. But they set up a makeshift kind of a podium here and some seats on the hills. And this is where the university is dedicated. Okay, so this is the actual place today. There's very much a connection both to the Temple Mount, but also to the desert. Okay? And the idea is new beginnings, a connection to the prophets, to eternity, right? It's a very beautiful idea of the desert. They create an amphitheater there. See another picture at the end. The amphitheater is built by an architect whose name is Fritz Kornberg. And again, this is the 1920s. They didn't know so much about acoustics, and he definitely didn't know anything about acoustics. And yet he's hired to design this amphitheater. And in order to learn about acoustics, he goes to a theater in Jerash in Jordan. And he has his wife come along, and they bring like a portable record player, and she plays in one part of the theater, and he sees if he can hear it in another part. part. Needless to say, this was not really super helpful and the acoustics are not too wonderful, but it is an incredible, incredible view from the theater here. One of the things that's nice when you're up in the theater looking out at the desert, you can see, today it's a little bit too built up, but it's still interesting to see. You can see the Arab neighborhood of Isawiya, which is right on the outskirts of Jerusalem. Some people suggest this is the biblical Nov, Nov, which is not in Jerusalem, but it is in the area of the tribe of Benjamin, and that's what we're looking at here. It's a kind of a nice connection. Some of the first buildings that are here, right, the very first building that's here, is the library, right? What's built originally as the library of the university. Today, it's the law school. And it was turned into the law school, but it was first built as a library, and it's really a very, very beautiful building. The famous story about this building, besides the fact that its architecture is really nice, and anybody who frequents the Mount Scopus campus knows that there are some beautiful old buildings, and then there's the modern campus that was built in the 70s, which is a maze and is horrible, and everybody, students and professors, hate. So the old buildings are really very nice. The famous story about this building is that in 1967, the second day of the Six-Day War, Moshe Dayan comes up to Mount Scopus. This is when they're determining whether or not they should take the old city. He's taken up to the roof of this building so he can get a strategic, you know, sense of where the university is positioned and can they take the old city. And he's said to have proclaimed, "What a divine view," right? Because you can see right to the Temple Mount. This did not convince him that you should take the old city, but he did admire the view. So that's the library. Albert Einstein has a deep connection to the university. Albert Einstein is offered the presidency of the university. He's also offered the presidency of the State of Israel. He declines both of them, but he's very supportive of the university as a scholar who left Europe and found a haven in Princeton, New Jersey. He understood the need for Jewish scholars to get out and to have a place to go. And he believed that the university could really serve that purpose. As you can see here, this is the math building. It's Machon Einstein, La Mathematica. He delivers the very first lecture in this building in 1923. He gives a lecture in French, but he says the first few words in Hebrew, so that the first lecture in the university will be in Hebrew. Einstein is very important, not just as like a nice inspirational figure, but he actually donated all the rights to all his actual intellectual property and the rights to his intellectual property to the university. Which is very nice, because what that means is that every time you buy a mug with Albert Einstein's face on it, money goes to the university. Plus, they have all these important papers, but it is also a moneymaker for the university. Okay, a couple of last things before we get to what happens to the university between 48 and 67. Another important building that's built on the campus in 1941 is the archaeology building. It's called Beit HaNachut, the Atikot HaYudim, right? The House of Ancient Jewish Treasures. This is the first archaeology department the first Jewish archaeology department. The head of it is Eliezer Sukanik, who's the father of Yigael Yadin, but he's also himself a very, very important archaeologist. And this is the first Jewish archaeology, right? The first excavations, Beit Alpha and other places. Hebrew University takes part in excavations and brings back some of the artifacts here, and they still are there. And it also gives us a little bit of a window into who are the professors in the Hebrew University in the first decade or so, two decades of its existence. And partly because of the need to leave Nazi Europe and partly because of the Zionist excitement, let's call it that, you have an incredible constellation of professors, certainly in Jewish studies, but in other places as well. So just to give you on the Jewish side, right? Eliezer Sukanik in archaeology, Martin Buber, Yitzhak Ber, Jewish history, Gershon Shalom in Kabbalah, Mordechai Kaplan, Shlomo Goitein, who was very involved in the study of the Cairo Geniza, Yosef Klausner, also an important Jewish historian. These are the names of Jewish studies in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and they're all in Hebrew University. Okay, let's talk briefly before we run out of time about what happens here between 48 and 67. Okay. In the War of Independence, as we know, at the end of the war, the lines are drawn. The Jordanians get the eastern plus the north and the south. Israel gets the west. But we have this enclave of Mount Scopus that stays within Israeli hands. And it's a very strategic and important enclave. We're not giving it up, right? We have this strategic view onto the old city. It's a very important site, but it's deep within Jordanian territory. Part of the ceasefire agreements with Jordan meant that every 2 weeks, a convoy could go up and replace or supplement the policemen that were up on Mount Scopus. Okay, according to the ceasefire agreements, it was only allowed to be policemen, but it was an open secret that all sorts of soldiers were sent up there, all sorts of armaments were sent up there. Everybody understood that eventually there'd be a battle and this would be a strategic point. And there was a lot of stockpiling of arms up here. There was a lot of improvised use of the university buildings, of the hospital building. Ultimately, what happens is that Mount Scopus becomes the jumping off point to enter the old city, right? On the first day of the war, first night of the war, Israel takes Ammunition Hill and then moves towards the east, Rockefeller Museum, area of Sheikh Jarrah, up to Mount Scopus and Mount of Olives, and then down on the third day to take the old city. So very important. In the 19 years that this is held by Israel, it's actually a relatively peaceful site. There is one attack in 1958, okay, and there are casualties, but in general, it's a pretty quiet place. After the Six-Day War, there are the new campuses of the university and of the hospital, but the old campuses are rejuvenated as well. So here you have the new campus of Hadassah in Karem, right, over here, which it's at the edge of the city, right? We did a Karim in our first lecture in the series, and the new campus of Hebrew University in Givat Ram. And today, both the campuses are used. They're both very important. Before the campus of Givat Ram was built, there were a lot of buildings that were kind of improvised and used for the university in Mamila, in Terra Sancta, in downtown Jerusalem, right? All different places, but then the new campus was built. The renewed campus of Hebrew University, like I said, has many detractors because the building is basically a maze, but it has a few beautiful things. One of them is the synagogue, which is the Hecht Synagogue, which I don't know how much you can see it in this photograph. You really have to come and see it. It looks directly, you're facing directly onto Har HaBayit, right? So it's a beautiful location for a synagogue. Then you have various parts of the campus. One of the things that was very terrible here in 2002 as part of the Second Intifada, there was a terror attack here in the cafeteria, which is right over here in the background of this picture on the right. Students were killed. Two of them were American students. It was a very, very terrible event. And in memoriam to the students, eight students, if I'm remembering correctly, the same sculptor who rejuvenated the botanical gardens, Ron Morin, he made this sculpture. You say it's a tree. It's not a sculpture. It is a sculpture because it's a tree that's on its side, meaning it's life that's been upended. Right. It's very subtle. It's not a huge wall with, you know, red, but it does express that something terrible happened here and things will never be the same. This is our final look, right? Our look to eternity from the theater of Hebrew University, looking out in the desert. And with that, we will bring our Mount Scopus to a close. Let's take a look at what some people have written here. Okay, going back, sorry. Okay. All right, let's see. Australians of Beersheba, yes. Jerusalem is our national anthem. Chariots of Fire featured the Jerusalem hymn. Did those feet in ancient times? I don't think that's the name of it. Is that the name of it? Okay, I'll believe you. Mount Scopus fit the criterion of those times, that hilltops with good fresh air were preferred. Yes, I agree, but that is not the only reason, meaning we have lots of hills. You could have gone to Talpiot, you could have gone in lots of directions. But the idea of the connection to the Temple Mount, the connection to the desert, being in the city, but not in the city, right? All of these ideas are very important. Jerusalem, or the emanation of the giant Albion. Okay, that's a nice name. Rowland Hill invented the British postal system. Thank you, Dr. Irene. I did not know that. That is very interesting. The botanical gardens, but so today there is another botanical gardens. You are correct. There is a botanical gardens by the Givat Ram campus. That is a much newer botanical gardens. This is the original one. The other one was built because this one was in a very sorry state. And now this one has been fixed up. That one is much bigger, but this one is also very beautiful. The amphitheater was the first thing rehabilitated after 67. Thank you. Yes. And in fact, we have famous speech that was given there, Yitzhak Rabin, right, who was the defense minister in 67, was the, sorry, not the defense minister, the Ramatkal, the chief of staff in 67. He got an honorary doctorate right after the war, and he gave a very famous speech about how the army is also a force for peace and a force for change. Very beautiful. Yes, the Mount Scopus we talked about in the beginning. Where in Talpiot is the war memorial? It is on, if I remember correctly, Rehov Korei HaDorot. It's a very strange little thing, but as you walk along, you'll see it. French Hill was the first new neighborhood. Yes, but this is not a neighborhood. This is the university. Pesach Learning Series, and
French
that is all.
Hill,
Thank you very much,
the
everyone.
neighborhood that practiced.
What?
French Hill is the neighborhood that basically surrounds a whole section of Mount Scopus,
Yes,
and that's
yes.
one of the reasons why it was built.
Okay. Thank you for adding that, Batya. Okay, everyone. Next
Thanks
week,
so
we will
much.
be back
It's a
for
Pesach.
our somewhat less well-known northern neighborhoods of Jerusalem, Neve Yaakov and Atarot. And that is the last one in the series. Next week, for Israelis at least, back to regularly scheduled time, 8:15, right, Shira? 8:15 in Israel,
That's
1:15
right.
in North America. Thank you,
Correct.
everyone.
Thank
Thank
you.
you, Shuli. Thank you, everyone, for being
Thank you.
here. Shavua
Thank
tov.
you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. One of a kind, Shuli. Take
Thank you
care.
very much.
Chodesh
Chodesh
tov.
tov.
Yes.